Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com, www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian on We Need the New Vannevar, that's Vannevar Bush, by the way, is, or soon will be available on the website www.westchesterguardian.com. It's the 129th column in the Creative Disruption series. In relation to this show, I've set up the GoFundMe site to ensure its ongoing sustainability, but as yet the response has been underwhelming. But you can change that. I do need to publicize it more. The actual URL is available at my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the on-air participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest next week on this show is writer, editor, and technologist Stephen Sherry, back to discuss writing and jobs in the future. Tune in and listen. I announced last week that my guest this week would be novelist, editor, entrepreneur, and radio host of Studio 360, Kurt Anderson. Kurt became caught in the last minute conflict and will join us November 2nd. I was fortunate to be able to revamp the schedule and bring in someone who is to join us later in the year. My guest tonight is the multifaceted Frank Hickey, a novelist with a long list of experience in investigation and adventure. I first met Frank at the monthly luncheon of the Narrowbacks, the group that meets monthly in the Heritage, the restaurant on McLean Avenue, to tell and to listen to stories, sing, and just enjoy good company. Frank was there with his latest book, Softening Flatbush, and we got to talking. As he led me through just parts of his life, I looked at him more closely and thought, gee, he looks very good for someone who must be 117 years old to have done all these things. But then I realized there are 8 million stories in the Naked City, and Frank's is one of the more interesting of them, so I must have him on the show. And that's what we'll do tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Frank, and welcome, and thank you for joining us on short notice.
Oh, thank you for having me here. This is going to be fun.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and then went to school there, and then changed over to Manhattan, and in Yorkville in the Upper East Side.
Oh, where'd you go there? My father lived in the first elevated apartment house in Yorkville.
Mm-hmm. I went to St. David's School in the Upper East Side.
Okay. In Softening Flatbush, your most recent book, you have the image of Ebbets Field on the title page. What's its significance?
Well, that's the neighborhood I grew up in. I remember going with my father and his friends to the ball games there when Ebbets Field was still thriving, and eating my first hot dog there and enjoying the ball games. It was just a couple of blocks from our house. And at that time, Flatbush seemed, and still seems to me, a magical neighborhood where everything is possible. And the years have not dimmed that feeling.
didn't you also mention to me that one of your ancestors had something to do with the building of Evansfield?
Oh, yes. The Hickey family, from what I understand, poured the concrete for Evansfield back in 1913. I didn't know about this until my father had passed on, but that became part of family lore.
If I remember correctly, you had major health problems as a child. Tell us about them and how you coped with them, please.
I was sickly. I was weak. They thought that I had leukemia. I was born prematurely, which in those days was very tense, much more than now. I became nearsighted as a result of being born prematurely, very nearsighted. And my life was, to use a Victorian phrase, despaired of a few times. My mother, however, brought me to cloistered nuns in a convent in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And for some unknown reason, the diseases went away and I became healthy again.
Then how long did they go on? Then how did you cope with them yourself, personally?
I would say I was sickly until I was about 7 years of age, very frail. I remember a lot of doctor's transfusions, hair falling out, and mysterious burning treatments.
You mentioned in your note to me that during that time, when you were cooped up at home, that you began to be the real fan of the show that I mentioned earlier, The Naked City. That was one of favorites. That was one of my favorite shows. Both the half hour one with John McIntyre and James Franciscus, but more the hour show with Horace with Horace McMahon and Paul Burr.
Very true. Very true. Those were the cornerstones of my growing up. I think I wanted to be a detective from the first time I could see those shows. I thought that was a great way to live.
If you were such a sickly kid, what did your family think about you and embarking at the age of 17 on the tour that took you to Europe?
I was robust and healthy by that time, and they thought I would be back in a couple of weeks. I came back after 2 years. I was actually 2 years in total over there. And I'd seen a lot over there, but they were used to my restlessness. They weren't in favor of it, but they understood it.
You mentioned the living in the cave. Tell us about Europe and living in a cave.
I came to a small town where the road stopped and the railroad track stopped on the south coast of Sicily. And I couldn't go on because the land was too rocky. And just then, I spoke very little Italian and even less Sicilian. A Scirocco storm hit. I didn't know what a Scirocco was. The car hadn't been invented then. The word was not in the English vocabulary. And a fierce windstorm, gray skies, howling winds. And the locals brought me to a cave where they had kept hidden out during World War II and later on during the earthquake of 1967. It didn't take a lot of brains to figure out that I should go inside the cave until the Scirocco storm stopped. It took about a week. I wound up staying for months in that town of 35 people in Sicily and learning a lot about the language and the culture.
Do you pick up languages rapidly? Or I am awful with languages, but I've got friends that just soak them up.
I am not afraid of making a fool of myself, as a lot of my friends tell me. There are times when I will leave a Chinese restaurant and say, "Thank you, everyone was delicious." I'll make mistakes all the time, but I'm not really worried about that. I try to strive and continue and learn what I can. And when you're isolated in a town like that, you're going to learn the language. It takes no skill.
What else did you do in Europe? Then how did you support yourself for 2 years?
I worked. I picked grapes. I unloaded trucks. In that town in Sicily, I managed to get a job tending bar, cleaning restaurants, waiting tables, working where I could, as I said, picking the grapes, working from place to place, casual labor, and my expenses were very low. I slept outdoors for most of those 2 years. Naturally, I stayed closer to warmer climates.
And where else did you go in Europe during the 2 years?
All right, I lived in France, in the south of France, in Germany, where I worked off and on there. All over France, different places, Spain, Morocco, the former Yugoslavia, Greece, Turkey, and I think that's pretty much it. I traveled very slowly.
Then what brought you home?
I wanted to come home. I was curious about what it was like. I had run out of money, too, and winter was getting fierce, and I was writing a lot, and I realized that living in Europe, it would take me a lot longer to get published, to get known, to be established as a writer, whereupon in the States I'd have some advantages that I didn't have living from hand to mouth in Europe.
How did you come to get hired as a fairly young person as a private investigator? And I believe you told me that you were the only white in the firm of all black investigators. Tell us about all those adventures, please.
Well, when I came back from Europe, I had only languages. I couldn't drive a car. I was severely nearsighted, as I said. And I went to the Yellow Pages and opened it up and went down the list of detective agencies. I had some very interesting interviews with different agencies. At that time, there were a lot of colorful, very widely variated different private detective agencies in New York City. And I found a job with one in the World Trade Center and fell in love with the work immediately.
And you mentioned that you were all over with the agency with other work in New Orleans and the West Coast and everything. Take us through your career as a PI.
All right. Well, that agency in the World Trade Center was pretty much in New York City. Once in a while, we'd have cases upstate. But I liked the work so much that later on I moved to New Orleans and worked as a private detective down there for 2 years. It was very different from what I'd done in New York. I was on the bayou most of the time. For a long time, I was undercover on a supply boat in the Gulf of Mexico. I was using my French in the Cajun-speaking French areas in the bayous of Louisiana and roaming across the state on other kinds of investigations. Louisiana in the 70s was a very wide-open, freewheeling kind of place. I believe it probably still is. And we had all varieties of investigations there. And some of the cases brought me to San Francisco, and I liked San Francisco, and I moved there and worked briefly there in private detective work.
What kind of cases does a private detective handle? What we're normally familiar with, the Sam Spade and the murder mm-hmm. cases and that. Take us through some of the cases that you had.
Sure. What I liked and what I specialized in as much as I could was murder defense cases here in New York City. At the time, legal aid did not handle murder cases. If you were accused of a homicide and you had not enough money to hire your own attorney, under the law, the court would appoint a private attorney, and he could use your services as an investigator for very low pay, and you would do a defense investigation for that client. The cases, I found them fascinating. The money was negligible. I'd be afraid to think how little money I made during those years. But as I said, the cases drew me and held me, and there were no set hours. There were no set regulations, except, of course, you had to tell the truth and write written reports, and do everything you could. You operated under the lawyer's privileged communications. At the time I was working, very few people in the field spoke Spanish, and I was using my Spanish all the time through the neighborhoods of New York, looking for people, speaking to witnesses, and wrapping up cases like that. There were other civil cases that were insurance cases, and they were your bread and butter. And you did them to keep things going. You would often be juggling, say, 6 or 7 small civil insurance car crash cases, slippery sidewalk cases, and 2 or 3 murder defense cases. I always gave priority to the murder defense cases because, of course, the stakes were much higher with somebody's life at stake.
Now, without violating any confidences, how would you start out on the murder defense case? I'm accused of killing the guy down the block. Witnesses mm-hmm. think they saw me did it. I swear I was home with my wife, who's of course going to defend me. What would you do then?
All right. You could only do this through the attorney, and you would meet with the attorney and go over whatever paperwork he had on the case. Then very often you'd visit the defendant in Rikers Island, and he would tell you what had happened. And once you were able to convince him that everything he told you was privileged information, just as if you were his lawyer or his lawyer's interpreter, then you would go out to the street, the sooner the better, and start working on those sources of information, people that knew what had happened, people that might have known what was happening. You'd canvass the area. If the murder happened on Friday at 6 p.m., you'd go to that same street Friday at 6 p.m., and without any preamble, talk to people about what they might have seen at that time. You'd take a statement from them, written if you could, and that would be introduced into evidence in his defense.
Now, the very often you hear lawyers say that they don't want the defendant to tell them whether or not they actually committed the crime, because they want to provide the best defense and they can't let the accused perjure himself. What if you found out that, from in your best judgment, that the fellow actually did it? Do you go back and tell the attorney that?
Since I'm operating under the attorney's privilege, I can tell him that. And I've found very often the lawyer does want to know what happened.
Okay.
And that he can mount a more effective defense that way. And I've seen lawyers get upset when the people don't tell them the truth. So okay. I've, for the most part, the lawyer said, yes, he admitted the same thing to me, Frank, and let's see where we can go with this.
You mentioned San Francisco. I believe from your notes to me that you were injured there. What happened there?
There was an arson in the hotel. My hand got gashed there. Wasn't badly injured, but it was colorful. And we were supposed to be protecting the hotel during a strike.
Then you came back to New York City, and you went back to the same agency. You also went to college at John Jay, and you wrote for the Brooklyn News Service. How did you cram all of that into a 24-hour day?
It wasn't easy. Believe me, it wasn't easy. The newspaper thing was very interesting. I found it very similar to detective work, and I kept going on adrenaline. I was a lot younger then and a lot of coffee. And as I said, the enthusiasm for that and carrying a full caseload at John Jay, I liked it very much.
Is your assistant, McGee, the long-term TV news reporter, older or younger than you? And was she reporting when you started writing for the news service?
No, she is younger, and she was reporting, but not in New York City.
Okay. You wrote me that you then got lucky, and someone noticed your passion for investigation and channeled you to the Queens DA's office and started you on the path that led to the Manhattan DA's office, to Savannah, Georgia Police Force, Hong Kong, Thailand, back to Manhattan DA's office, and then to LAPD. We had to lose 30 pounds and 5 inches to get through the academy. You served under Bill Bratton in L.A. and finally back to Manhattan DA's office. 2 years in Queens, 10 years and 3 stints in Manhattan, 4 years in Georgia, 12 years in L.A., as well as all the time in Asia. That's a lifetime in itself. Why such a gypsy life? And take your time, take us through all of this, please.
Well, I always wanted to see more of the world. Even now, even tonight as we're speaking. And I was always curious about what would happen if I took this job. And I always went for the interesting work. The Savannah, Georgia Police Department was very different from the New York City culture when I joined there. And so too was the Los Angeles Police Department. And I feel blessed and lucky to have been able to get those jobs and to survive in those places and learn whatever I could, and hopefully make myself a more effective police officer, more effective detective, through the different cultures and the different training.
Now, how did you go from the PI firm to the Queens DA's office right in the beginning of this whole thing?
They, at that time and now, each borough has their own investigators who are police officers, but distinct from the NYPD. I was never in the NYPD, and they will train you, send you through a state-certified police academy. When you come out, you're equipped with a gun and a shield, and you right away start doing complex investigations, just as a police detective would, but under the direction and the behest of the district attorney.
So how did you happen to get there? Just someone noticed you and they channeled you there? Who was that? Then how did it happen?
I had put in resumes there because I knew about the job. I couldn't get in the NYPD because of my eyesight, and there were no such eyesight requirements in the DA's office. If you could qualify with a handgun, that was fine. And they called me in for an interview and offered me the job.
Now, in Manhattan, in addition to the DA investigators, I knew a friend of mine at one time was the commissioner of the investigation for the city of New York. How does that differ, if you know, from the DA's investigators or the NYPD's investigators?
The commission of investigations, that might be Department of Investigations, or it could be the special commission on investigating the school system.
It was Department of Investigation, fellow named Pat
McGinley. DOI. Right. Well, DOI has been around since, I believe, 1912. It was called the Bureau of Accounts, and it's one of the oldest law enforcement agencies in the city, primarily to look at waste and corruption growing out of the Boss Tweed era. And they focus on criminal things and also internal, as I said, fraud and corruption matters. So that's different from prosecuting cases under the district attorney's office.
So on a district attorney's office, you're, if I understand it correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, to once someone is indicted, then the ongoing investigation goes over to a district attorney investigator, or the NYPD continue in gathering information on the case?
The district attorney's office initiates many of their investigations on their own. They don't wait for an indictment to come in. Because the title goes back, as I mentioned to you, to the 1930s, in Manhattan at least, under District Attorney Tom Dewey, where he felt that to have an independent group of investigators would be very helpful for him, and not having to involve the NYPD. There was a television show called The DA's Man that I remember back in the 50s, and a book about the same office, where they operated independently of all other government agencies, just working primarily for the district attorney's office, and very often running for years in undercover and very complex cases.
Now, what about cases that there is an arrest from NYPD and then an indictment? Do you still get involved in those cases, or does that stay with NYPD?
Sometimes it does go to the DA because, once again, the district attorney, the assistant district attorney who's preparing the case, he can reach out to the investigators with much less paperwork since they work directly for the DA's office. It can be as simple as walking down the hall and saying, I need an investigator to go out and speak to these people. And he doesn't have to go through requesting that from the NYPD.
Now, in the middle of your work in the United States, you mentioned Queens and then Manhattan and then Georgia, going off to Asia, and you were in two areas there. How did that work?
I wasn't working at the time. I had resigned from the Savannah, Georgia Police Department. I was planning to make a new life for myself in Asia, and so I did. I flew over there with the name of a few contacts and a pretty good dark blue suit, and I wanted to see what I could do for myself in Asia in my line of work.
And how long were you in Hong Kong? And how long in Thailand?
Not long enough, just about 2 months, 1 or 2 months total.
Okay.
Not long enough.
And then you came back to Manhattan DA's office, huh?
Well, there was a serial killer case that I was very involved in. I'd been looking for this man for 10 years. And when I was working in Thailand, he surrendered. And I thought, and I was asked if it would be a good idea for me to come back and help with the case. It was one of those cases that had interested me, as I said, for 10 years, and I'd worked on it for 10 years, and I had to give up my Asian life with some misgivings and come back to New York.
What eventually happened with that case?
He confessed to 4 killings. He was somewhat of an enigma. He was on the front page of the New York Times for the entire week that he surrendered. He had been free to do his killings in about a 20-year period. Myself and the other detectives, and there's some really good detectives I worked with on the case. I was just hanging on by my thumbnails on that case. They felt that he had killed many more people than admitted, and that we needed to do a thorough investigation, even interrogating him in prison as to the other people that he may have killed. Unfortunately, he died in prison of a heart attack before we could get going on that angle of him.
Now, what was his story? I don't remember the case, or I don't know his name, but I mean, is he? We read about the serial killers who have some agenda that we don't know about, or others, they just randomly kill people. Do we know? I mean, did they kill people that he knew, or did they just kill people?
He killed people that he knew. His name was Ricardo Silvio Caputo. He was an Argentinian national who came to New York in 1971 and held casual jobs and killed his first girlfriend. And there are three books written about him. And he was free from 1974 until he surrendered in 1994. The feeling was he surrendered because he had noticed stakeouts around him, and being a very shrewd man, very smart, very canny, he decided it was better to surrender and to try to work his way out of the prison. He'd done that before.
A friend of mine, Don Delaney, was the senior investigator with New York State Police. He was one of the people that arrested this serial killer in Queens who had been killing prostitutes. He actually had bodies in the back of his truck. And I don't know whether they were ever able by interrogation to find out just what motivated him. That's there was something we just don't understand, I guess.
Yes.
And then
Ricardo only killed upscale women. He never killed a man, and he never used a gun. They were usually his intimate partners.
And I guess obviously the one didn't know about the last one, or she wouldn't have been his partner, I guess, huh?
Well, the second one actually was his prison psychologist in Fishkill, whom, depending on what story you wish to believe, she became his second murder victim. But it wasn't in Fishkill, that was in Yonkers.
Now, did he get out of Fishkill or did he escape?
He did not get out of Fishkill. He was moved from Fishkill to Ward's Island, to an unsecure facility where he could come and go as he wished during the daytime.
And this was when he was in Fishkill for murdering the first person, or was there some other...
This was when he was still serving his sentence for the first murder. They moved him, as I said, from Fishkill into Manhattan.
Yeah, I pass Fishkill fairly often, and it looks like a very secure area. There are two prisons, I'm not sure which is what, they're on both sides of Route 84. And then working with the Army, you know, also trained MPs for police action in Afghanistan. How'd you get into that?
Not so much MPs as regular soldiers.
Okay.
I wanted to go up against the Taliban. I wanted to go up against the biggest challenge that an investigator could have right now, and that seemed to be that. And I applied for overseas work because I was comfortable with having lived overseas and speaking foreign languages. And they contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in going, attaching myself to either a Marine or an Army unit, and going to Afghanistan with the troops and training all the way in police tactics, and at the same time attempting to dismantle the bomb network in Afghanistan as a working investigator.
Now, this is very different. I mean, you're going into a combat zone. You're not looking for criminals, or you're not looking for evidence. You're going into a zone that people could be shooting at you, or they could be lobbing mortars at you. It would seem that would be very different than what you had been doing in all of your career.
Well, I'd worked in Los Angeles in areas that were very violent, but it wasn't a war zone, of course. Yes, it would have been very different. I never got to Afghanistan, as I mentioned to you. I fell ill in the training, and they decided not to send me over.
Okay. Did you got something out of it, though, and you made a reasonable contribution during your time there?
Yes.
You mentioned community policing and reporting to that. That's a big part of your Max Royce detective novels and part of your mission designed to slither with the Army. You mentioned, and you know, to me, that to your knowledge, the Royster books, only books to focus on community policing. What led you to focus on it, and why do you think you're the only one that we know of to do the same?
Well, first of all, it's a very new phenomenon. I don't think it's more than 26 years old in the current vernacular.
Would you define it for us before you go any
sure.
further?
Okay. Most people would say that it started, it could be another name for just regular old-fashioned traditional policing, which has been going on for 150 years. But the current wave of community policing is marked with the 1988 article called Broken Windows, written by, I believe, George Kelling, where the theory was that if you have a broken window on a building and nobody comes to fix it, soon that building and that neighborhood go into a spiral where they feel that nobody cares about the neighborhood, and there'll be drunks hanging out by the building. Nobody will move them along. There'll be marijuana sales by the building for the same reason. The locals feel that the city doesn't care enough to fix a broken window, nor move the drunks, nor move the marijuana salesmen, which will escalate into drug warfare when hard drugs get sold there and bullets will fly. That's the theory in a nutshell. And it's been used as a way of combating crime across the country, where you fix that window, you do fix that corner, you do move on all crimes, large or small, and you move with tact, with the community values in mind, but you take action.
That wasn't Bratton one of the early advocates of that also?
Yes, he was. Absolutely, he was.
And when you were working in L.A., did you see much of that work?
Yes, I did. Well, I pushed for it. I started doing it really in Georgia, and it was mostly out of curiosity to see what would happen if you got out of the car and walked and talked with the people. And I found it very exhilarating. I saw it making a difference, and it put new life into my work. And the people liked it very much. They told me in Georgia that they'd never spoken with an officer as much as they'd spoken with me, that I'd become part of the community. And Savannah, despite its physical beauty, was a very dangerous town at that time with very high crime rates. So I carried my ideas and my enthusiasm from Savannah to Los Angeles with that.
You also describe it in your novels as the place where, in addition to the police force, that the locals get involved. There are even local groups that try to support the police that way. Does that happen in New York City?
Oh, yes. It happens all the time. As I would tell my officers in the different departments, everybody wants to be in a police movie. They want to be in a police movie as either the witness, the good guy, the helper, the hero. So let them roll, or the informant, let them do it. Let them star. Tell them that you owe them a lot of thanks, and you do, because ultimately it's their neighborhood. And you're doing what they would like to be able to do, and with persuasion and tact, you can explain to them that even the unpopular things, like writing tickets and doing traffic stops, will make their neighborhood safer and let their children grow up.
Speaking of police movies, you also co-wrote a screenplay. As an aside, my son is an L.A. TV writer. Tell us about the screenplay and what's going on with it.
Well, the movie is not police. It's not a police movie. It's called Spy. It has to do with organized crime and eavesdropping in modern society. And what happens when a professional eavesdropper, a young man, who falls in love with the person that he's being hired to watch and to eavesdrop on, and uncover a scheme dealing, as I said, with organized crime. But there are very few police people in the movie, and it's primarily a love story wrapped around electronic surveillance in New York City.
That's interesting, because obviously both with the Snowden revelations and with the cameras every place and with drones, there's much talk about of surveillance. I've written extensively about it from a technology and the policy end. How do you come down on all this? Obviously, some people think it's turning us into a 1984 police state. Other people feel that it's providing security that we didn't have. Now, how do you come down?
I'm not worried about a 1984 police state. I'm very much for civil rights and civil liberties. But I do see many times where it clears up crimes, where you have pictures of people you wouldn't otherwise have. The current debate about whether police should wear body cameras or not, having been a police officer in some very dicey areas, I'm all in favor of the body cameras being worn, because almost always they will present a clear picture of what really happened, and we need that.
And as a
patrol officer, I always felt I was being photographed, filmed anyway. Not much difference.
In some jurisdictions, they've tried to stop the locals from filming a police action with their iPhones or whatever. And in most cases now, that's been declared to be something that they can't do, that the public has the right to inform themselves and others of police activity while they're doing their duties. Do you have any problems with that, with the officers being photographed?
Not at all. As I said, I often was, and I was used to it, and I've never had any problems with that whatsoever.
It's interesting. It's just come a long way. My grandfather was he was a cop. He was the chief of the pickpocket detail when pickpocketing was the big deal in New York City after the turn of the century, and he wound up as a after retired, he was chief of security for the now defunct Daylines, and my father was a cop, and my godfather was a cop, and my son was researching something for a screenplay on crime in New York City, and he coincidentally came across my grandfather's name looking into the Irish criminals about the early 1900s when pickpocketing was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on with the movie? You sent me a note that you showed it someplace in New York City, didn't you?
Oh, yes. It opened at the Tribeca Big Apple Film Festival. That was a couple of years back. And it's out on Amazon now. And it opened in a few other places in New York.
Are you going to continue in the screenwriting business, do you feel?
Yes. I enjoy it the same way I enjoy writing novels. I think you said in one of your earlier podcasts you have a need to evangelize, to share your knowledge with other people, let them know what you know, and spread the knowledge around. I feel that way about writing and movies.
Tell us about the series, the detective novel series.
This Max Royster is the series hero throughout this, and Max is not a sleek modern yuppie hero. He's fat, broke, divorced, thrown off the NYPD for depression after 2 years of negligible service. He lives in a rent-controlled small studio on the Upper East Side. Nevertheless, with all these problems, especially being over 60, he is a ballroom dancer and manages to keep a cheery and happy frame of life, even with all these problems, and blunders into cases and gets committed to them, and uses a wide variety of friends, educated people, roustabouts that he calls his playpen irregulars, playpen being the Upper East Side. And like the Baker Street irregulars, they help him out on cases. He's very much a New Yorker to his fingertips.
And do you see, as you have him getting older, and you said he's in the 60s, do you see an end to his adventures in your writing, or are you going to carry him on until he's 110?
I'm going to carry him on.
Okay.
I'm going to carry him on. You get tired sometimes of everybody being perpetually 25 in detective fiction and living and drinking and eating upscale and being sleek and sophisticated all the time. Max is none of those things. And he and I are going to stay together for a long time.
Let's Let's talk some about writing. You mentioned to me that one of your favorites is a fellow who you may know as Salvador Albert Bambino. Do you know who that is?
No, I don't.
That was the birth name of...
Oh. Evan Hunter. I'm sorry.
Right.
Evan
right.
Hunter. It took a minute.
And you mentioned how much you enjoyed the 87 Priest, which I did, obviously, and reading about the deaf man all the way through. And I thought the television show was well done, but the books are better. Tell me about your liking for that and all the other authors that you were hung up on.
Well, I can remember reading Cop Hater, the first one in the series and the first one I ran into. I can remember finishing it and enjoying it very much. I can remember where I was 50 years ago or so when I read the second book in this series, The Mugger, and laughing out loud at some of the witticisms there. I mean, McBain had the knack for knowing New York City and being able to show the wild, funny characters in there who move through it and maintaining the tension in the book. He created a police procedural with the detective squad of the 87th Precinct as a family, with the Lieutenant Burns as a stern father and the errant kids who go off and do their thing and Corella as the hero.
Cotton
and
Hawes.
He did a marvelous job, I thought. I thought those people became real-life friends to you, and you were glad to see how they were going through life. You don't see that in I'm going to sound like I'm old now. You don't see that in a lot. I don't see that. I don't feel that in a lot of current detective fiction.
The what I like very much, and of course, you'd have the better insight in the way things work. Robert K. Tannenbaum's novels, where he has the district attorney in New York City first as an assistant DA, and his fiance and his wife is an assistant DA, and she becomes a pseudo vigilante when a terrorist thing knocks her eye out, and it's just a very interesting series. He worked under Hogan, and then he was the prosecutor of the case, you may remember, when the people had that bank robbery and the killed cops in Rockland County.
In Nyack, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he was the prosecutor, and he wrote a book about that was very well received. So he started writing this fiction with some very interesting characters to me. And I was on about his 12th book when it came out that he really didn't write them. He didn't do well writing fiction, and his cousin, who was a minor league writer, he hadn't sold very well, but he had written fiction. He took the books over, and mm-hmm. it was only years later that it came out that he was the actual writer, but they're still under Tannenbaum's name.
Mm-hmm.
Who else do you like?
I like the late George V. Higgins, who had written The Friends of Eddie Coyle,
right,
and then went on to write about 33 other books in the next 30 years. Some of uneven quality, but always worth reading. He was a born listener. The dialogue in his books grabs you and holds you and won't let go. And he writes very profoundly in very few sentences. I always found his books to be very interesting. I wish he was still around writing more books.
Just very interesting.
And there are so many others out there. Go ahead.
You mentioned the dialogue and the listening. A fellow who I enjoyed very much, we used to email back and forth before he had an untimely accident, was Andrew Greeley. Andrew Greeley had a wonderful ear for the Irish-American and the Irish voice. He just picked that up extremely well. So,
mm-hmm.
You also mentioned the famous ones, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. Ross MacDonald, I found to be uneven. After a while, it bored me, his books. I liked them. But he always had someone coming out of the woodwork who was really the illegitimate son of someone who had been out of the country for 30 years, and all of a sudden he shows up in the case. John D. MacDonald, I liked his non-Travis McGee books even better than his Travis McGee books.
Right.
They were on your list, just people who you liked.
Yeah, they were.
All, there were also people that I didn't know. You mentioned William Rowley Weeks, and I didn't know anything about him. You said that he wrote one book, he did very well, and he just disappeared.
Yes, he did. That may have been from his Army intelligence training. Nobody knew much about him until he died. When he died, there was an obituary about him. He wrote his first book, and it won the Edgar Award, I think, for 1957. And it was wonderfully done, about the Cold War espionage in Europe, called Knock and Wait a While. And then he never wrote anything else after that. And it might have been because it was a tough act to follow. Maybe he was smart enough to know he had only one book in him. But Pulp Fiction is full of people like that. By pulp, I don't mean to degrade it. I mean what you would call tough guy writing or crime fiction. Mysterious people who come in, burn brightly like a nova for a few years, maybe just one book, and then die very quietly somewhere else. And then years later, their books are sometimes found, and people say, as in printing, the printing houses like Black Lizard Books with Jim Thompson or the Hard Case Crime series, these are wonderful writers. How come we didn't know about these people?
The fellows who I like very much are one fellow anyhow, and I liked his Nate Heller series. I liked his the whole bunch of things that he's done is Max Allen Collins, but he doesn't seem to be writing as much anymore since he had both the graphic novel and the screenplays. Do you like him?
I don't know him that well. Certainly not as well as you do, but I will look into him if you like him.
Yeah,
it's not hard at all.
So I like him very much. You said at the end of your note to me that you're waiting for the next adventure. Do you know what that is? What are your new plans?
I knew what it was. It wouldn't be the next adventure. No, I don't know what it is at this point. I'm happy to be back in New York City.
Let's pick up some of these callers. Hang on.
Sure.
From the 569 or the 559, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is Tim. I'm a veteran in the Veterans Home in California. I want to let you know that you're speaking to the most wonderful guy in the world.
Well, that's nice. How do you know Frank?
Oh, I met him. About a year ago, maybe more, when he was traveling through a little town called Barstow, California, where the wind blows all the time, and he wrote a book, was hanging out with him and talking to him the whole area, the whole time he was out there. He used to visit me at the home.
Frank, what book is that he's speaking of?
That's the fourth book in the series called Can Showbiz's Crush Crime? It talks about Max Royster going to the desert town of Basta, California, where I lived in that town for more than a year and wrote about it while I was there.
Okay.
It's a great book. It's a great book.
Thank you.
Okay. Carla, do you have anything else for us?
Well, I wrote a couple of short stories about my adventures at sea. I put 20 years working on Navy ships and visited 70 ports in the world and had some good experiences aboard these ships and in the ports. And I tried to write a couple of short stories about it, but I haven't got anywhere.
Okay, well, keep it going. Stephen King was rejected 26 times before he hit it, and I think he's done fairly well after that. So,
Stephen King. Oh, God, I love his books.
So just keep working at it. Thanks for calling.
You take care of my good buddy there, will you, please?
I will. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, from 718.
He only got rejected 26 times? That's nothing.
Yeah. From 718, who's on the phone? Hello? 718-457-3642. Who do I have? I have someone banging tables. Once more, one last shot. Who are you? Okay, well, Well, thanks for calling anyhow. Okay. We've covered a whole lot of bases in exploring your life. What else would you want the audience to know about you, Frank?
Just that I get bored by predictable writing. I was bored by books that bored me, and I wrote the book so I would not be boring. They'd be different kinds of books. And as I mentioned, the second book in this series, Can Funny Bunny Hunt the Hornbug, is the only book that I know of that uses community policing as a way to solve a crime. As I said, community policing's new, 26 years old or so, and it hasn't been used as a vehicle to solve crimes in many fiction books. This one, I think, is the first one. And policemen who read it enjoy it. They say it's right on the money.
Now, in the Soft and Flatbush book, you show the great animosity between the Max and some of the officers that he previously worked for, to the extent that they won't pay any attention to him. Did you see that within many forces, that they weren't interested in civilians horning in on their responsibilities?
Well, Max had been a cop in that precinct and had been controversial even while he was a cop. So they don't so much see him as a civilian as somebody who had been one of them and was not anymore. And he'd made some enemies for himself doing that. I'm not Max Royster, as I keep telling people, but Max can ruffle a lot of feathers, and all progress depends on reasonable people, and Max can be very unreasonable.
How did you originally, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I met you at the Narrowbacks, how did you originally get hooked up with the Narrowbacks folks?
I had met friends of mine who belonged to the Narrowbacks and said they would love to show me their world. And I was very interested. And it's a rollicking, rousing, as you know, luncheon of story and song and morale building. And I find it very interesting and very enjoyable to go there.
Well, you sang to us. You're one of the ones.
I did indeed. Yes. Yes, I did. I used to sing to my clients in the back of the patrol car. They were something of a captive audience. And it made the day better for everybody involved.
And have you sung anyplace else?
When I was in, I sang my whole life. My mother was a Broadway actress. We were always encouraged to sing and to dance.
Oh,
so nothing new about that.
What did she act in?
She acted for 62 years, starting in Brooklyn, and managed to crack Broadway in the play Conduct Unbecoming, and kept working up until her death as an actress.
Wow.
So all of us children were always encouraged to sing and to dance.
That must have been an interesting childhood.
Yes, it was. I think I was about 10 years old before I realized that not everybody else's mother was an actress.
Yeah, well, the Irish Catholic neighborhood that I grew up in, many of the it was a big cops neighborhood. It's the same neighborhood that Danny Lynch came out of, and it's that many of the people whose fathers weren't cops, they were treasury agents or they were motor men or they were firemen. It was the age that many second generation Irish, anyhow, they were on the they were doing something for the city. They were on, you know, their own civil service in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Was Flatbush like that? Was it a
Flatbush, it was like that. It was blue collar. It was very open. I don't remember, to use a cliche, I don't remember doors being locked in the daytime or the nighttime. It was a wonderful neighborhood to grow up in and very relaxing, very safe. And I missed it very much when we had to move to Manhattan.
Now, no matter what you're doing, no matter what you wind up doing is an investigator or whatever, you're going to continue your writing life, obviously.
Absolutely.
Are you looking in any particular areas other than writing to go on to? Do you want to keep working in any investigative field, or do you want to do other things?
I keep an open mind, but I still love detective work.
Okay.
But other things that could interest me, yes, I'm interested in other things, but detective work has been the mainstay for a long time.
Okay. Let me try once more to get this, whoever this caller is who has an open line. It's 718-457-3652. Are you there? I guess he's not.
In one of your podcasts, you mentioned technology being a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable. I'm very happy that you're on. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's been a real pleasure. And in the words of Mets radio announcers, Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website. Go to
thank
my
you
website.
Thank you very much, John.
www.johnmack13.com for URLs for previous shows, schedules of upcoming shows, and the path to the GoFundMe location to keep this show going. My books may be found at Amazon.com as may Frank's. Tune in next week to Steve Cherry. Until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silva, steady. Thank you.